Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're kind of closing the week out on some property and some other little topics with Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. But before we do, that debt is fraud. And I want you to make sure that in your appeals to heaven, you continue to learn and pray on those things that you've learned. And then as you've asked the divine hand of providence, our creator, for assistance, get up and act like you got it. You know, don't be getting up and being timid. I don't think that timidity is what we would call a good characteristic. Anyway, your campaign begins now. We're already way too late, but there's, you know, no point in putting things off when, you know, we're only putting off the advancements that we need immediately. So we've got to get started. With that, I want to also include the whole point of your campaign has to be centered on constitutional compliance. And if we can get the people to recognize that we have a right to demand constitutional compliance, then there's no reason why every level of our government doesn't incorporate some form of guarantees of compliance. When we're talking about guarantees of compliance, we're talking about our public servants. So they can't create laws. They can't change or redefine the law like in the courts. They can't get away with, you know, assuming new roles or responsibilities or powers and so forth and so on. So anyway, welcome back, Tammy. And
thank you.
Is it snowing or sunny?
Sunny and cold. Sunny and warm.
Oh, sunny and warm. Now, warm there is above 32 degrees, right?
Right.
Okay. So we were just covering, and actually you can go ahead and read it again because it's just worth doing to keep the idea together. We're reading an area where Madison is kind of laying out all the powers that they were giving Congress to do. Some of these powers they were considering as admitting states into the union and so forth. And so why don't we go ahead and pick that up from the beginning. And then there's one part that's really highlighted. You'll notice that the font is maybe one or two sizes larger than the other font. And so when you finish reading that, we can stop and then have a good conversation about that.
Okay.
All right.
So Mr. Madison submitted an order to be referred to the Committee of Detail the following powers as proper to be added to those of the General Legislature to dispose of the unappropriated lands of the United States, to institute temporary governments for new states arising therein, to regulate affairs with the Indians as well as within as without the limits of the United States, to exercise exclusively legislative authority at the seat of the general government and over a district around the same, not exceeding blank square miles, the consent of the legislature of the state or states compromising the same being first obtained.
Okay, so when we look at the next body, go ahead and read that next line, the large font. Is it not large on yours?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, that's what I meant. Okay. Read that.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thanks.
To grant charters of incorporation in cases where the public good may require them and the authority of a single state may be incompetent.
Okay. So, folks, it was actually being discussed that the federal government could create corporations. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
That they were going to be granted the power to grant charters of incorporations in cases where the public good may require them.
Well, that's pretty broad.
It is broad, but it's a very specific and unique power that does not exist in the Constitution. In other words, here is something that they wanted to grant them, and obviously, I'll just say, more reasonable minds prevailed and actually said, we're not going to do this. We're not going to let them create incorporations. We're not going to let them go down this road. Okay, so up there also, the very first line that you mentioned, the quote, to dispose of unappropriated lands of the United States. What does that mean, to dispose of, to get rid of unappropriated land? Is there such a thing as land that wouldn't be of good service to the United States?
Thinking.
So there comes a point in time where nations realize that they would rather have this than that. And so they look at, you know, this land and go, you know what, we kind of have that, but we're not really using it, so we're going to go ahead and dispose of that. That never, ever came to be in the United States, other than the fact that the federal government assumed or picked up property, or I should say territories, and instead of actually putting them on a path to statehood, they just let them languish as a territory. Puerto Rico is being a good example. Mm-hmm. How long has Puerto Rico been a territory?
Long time.
Oh, yeah. Very, very, very long time. I think it goes back to the beginning.
Isn't Puerto Rico, they don't want to be, or do they?
And we should have kicked them to the curb. And we should not have ever considered them to be a part of America. And I just say that because there wasn't a real good reason other than we were just becoming, I'll just say, this is when America, when we started creating permanent territories, is when America actually put on a colonization hat. Because if the intent is not to bring a state or to adjoin some land to another state, and I'll give you a good case in point. Hawaii is a state, and it's a Pacific Island state. I believe that Hawaii should actually grow, and the name of Hawaii should actually end up changing by the people, because it should be the Pacific Islands. And that when you look at Hawaii, Hawaii would be, you know, a group of counties, as well as, let's say, the Philippines. There's 1,000 islands there. The Philippines becomes a state in the Pacific Islands. And so, obviously, Hawaii would be a small fish in that pond. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying...
What would be the benefit of Puerto Rico not wanting to become a state? Well, what's the benefit for them?
Well, the benefit for them would be that they would actually be able to do things for themselves and not have the federal government regulate them completely. But mm-hmm. the way the federal government has treated them, they've been basically... The best way to say this is they've been lulled into dependency on the federal teat.
I see.
Because that's what they've been
getting.
If you
do this, then you'll get this money.
Yep. And that, so I mean, during COVID, I think, was it COVID? No, I think it was before that. I believe that there was a point in the Obama administration where Puerto Rico was given all sorts of extra federal dollars and subsidies so that they could maintain their rum production.
Huh.
Yeah. Anyway, so again...
Because that's essential.
Yeah. So let's keep going through these powers, though. So obviously they did not include this power to grant incorporations. Go ahead. Let's keep going, though.
To secure to literary authors their copyrights for a limited time.
Okay, so limited time. Keep note that. Not permanent. In other words, not for a lifetime, you know, for as long as the author lives. Limited times. Mm-hmm. 5-10 years maybe. Okay, keep going.
To establish a university.
Did that happen? Is that in the Constitution?
No.
No, okay.
to encourage by premiums and provisions the advancement of useful knowledge and discoveries.
Uh-huh. Now, did in the encouragement of premiums and provisions be actually used? Or is that language in the Constitution?
Nope.
Nope. So as they tried to create, as you could see this, they were putting things in there that gave the federal government some powers to control and manipulate. Mm-hmm. And every single one of those things was removed and stricken out. And we don't have time necessarily to try to hunt down where these things are and how it was done. But it's clear that they actually did not, moving forward, these things started falling out of the Constitution. Keep going.
To authorize the executive to procure and hold for the use of the U.S. landed property for the erection of forts, magazines, and other necessary buildings.
Okay, so that's in there, but that's the language of that basically changed, but keep on going.
These propositions were referred to the Committee of the Detail, which had prepared the report, and at the same time, the following, which were moved on Mr. Pinckney in both cases unanimously, to fix and permanently establish the seat of government of the U.S., in which they shall possess the exclusive right of soil and jurisdiction.
Yes, okay. So, did that get into the Constitution?
No.
Okay. So,
because they don't own anything except for the
exclusive right of soil and jurisdiction. So, in other words, they weren't granted exclusive rights of jurisdiction and exclusive rights over soil. Was that in the there's nothing mentioning soil in the Constitution. In other words, the states were sovereign and they couldn't take away the states their resources. So, folks, here's the question. Why is it that you don't have full rights to your property? How is it that the federal government in any way has and possesses supposedly all unconstitutional, all rights to minerals and those rights underneath the feet or under your soil? Water rights, whatever you want to call it. They don't have any authority. Here you can see it was going into the Constitution. It didn't make the final cut.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, go read your state constitution. Does your state have mineral rights over your land? Do they possess all mineral rights for all land within the states? No.
No.
I'll bet you anything. You read your constitution, you will not find soil rights. So where? How in the heck did they take our soil rights?
Yeah, how did they?
By assuming and violating the Constitution, by taking on powers not delegated.
Hmm.
Okay, and a few more to go.
To establish seminaries for the promotion of literature and the arts of sciences.
Okay.
And sciences. To grant charters of incorporation. To grant patents for useful inventions.
Okay.
And to secure to authors exclusive rights for a certain time. They mentioned that again.
Yeah, so again, that's kind of a duplicative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that must be extra important to add a second time. But again, that's authors. But if you look up above, they talked about to secure authors exclusive rights for a certain time. Before that, to grant patents for useful inventions. To grant charters of incorporation. Again, that's kind of redundant as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Okay. To establish seminaries. What's a seminary?
I mean, that's religion.
Uh-huh.
Isn't it?
Well, so it's an education, but it's a religious educational institution.
Right.
Okay, all right. Okay. So that wasn't in there either.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how things started growing getting tailored down or cut down as they started moving more and more and closer to establishing the Constitution. So now go ahead and read the next one, to establish public institutions. Because we're going to read the rest of these.
Okay.
Most of these don't make the final cut. Keep going.
to establish public institutions, rewards, and immunities for the promotion of agriculture, commerce, trades, and manufactures, that funds which shall be appropriated for payment of public creditors shall not during the time of such appropriation be diverted or applied to any other purpose, and that the committee prepare a clause or clauses for restraining the legislature of the U.S. from establishing a perpetual revenue to secure the payment of public debt, to secure all creditors under the new Constitution from a violation of the public faith when pledged by the authority of the legislature, to grant letters of marque and reprisal to regulate stages on the post roads.
Okay, so what is that? To regulate stages on the post roads. What does that mean? They're going to have
post offices?
They're going to have theatrics along the post office routes?
I don't think it would be post office buildings. That's what I would.
Okay, so to regulate stages. So what do they call a wagon?
Yeah, that's true.
Ah. See, we have to really start thinking outside the box of, you know, how is that word back in those days applied? Because most people don't call a station wagon a stage,
mm-hmm.
right? But technically, a commuting or a, I'll say a mechanism of travel is by using, people paid money to ride in a stage so that you were kind of boxed in. And could you imagine that? You know, the dankness of the dust and the dirt and all of that. I mean, would you rather be up at the top in the elements, or would you rather be in a protected box with stinky people that you know haven't showered because they just don't have running water back then? Right? I mean, I guess people were not offended by...
Apparently, they couldn't have been.
By the natural person. You know, the naturalness of people. Because, boy, you really get natural if you don't, you know, maybe once a year or a few times a year you have a bath. Anyhow. Okay, so now we're going to actually start talking about and focusing on the militia. And it's not, you know, it doesn't go unnoticed if you really recognize who really cared about the militia, because it starts off with Mr. Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's now talk about the militia.
Okay, so Mr. Mason introduced the subject of regulating the militia. He thought such a power necessary to be given to the general government. He hoped there would be no standing army in time of peace, unless it might be for a few garrisons. The militia ought, therefore, to be more effectually prepared for the public defense. 13 states will never concur in any one system if the disciplining of the militia be left in their hands. If they will not give up the power over the whole, they probably will over a part as a select militia. He moved, as an addition to the propositions just referred to, the Committee of Detail, and to be referred in like manner a power to regulate the militia.
Ah, see, so now Mason's asking that they actually put that up there, but down, when we get into the ratification debates, now just keeping this in your mind, when we get into the Virginia ratification debates, we're going to find that Mr. Mason is very critical of how the militia was created or instilled in the Constitution. Very critical of it. I mean, here there's not, we haven't seen any mention of it. Okay, so Mr. Gary
remarked that some provision ought to be made in favor of public securities, and something inserted concerning letters of marque, which he thought not included in the power of war. He proposed that these subjects should also go to a committee.
Mr. Rutledge then moved to refer a clause that funds appropriated to public creditors should not be diverted to other purposes. In other words, when you actually say, okay, we're going to tax you for this much money, we're going to tax you for this much, and we're going to use it for this very specific purpose. In other words, making it, you know, unchangeable its course and destination. Right? So, because that's what happens all the time. I mean, do you know how many times that the Congress had raided the Social Security?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they did it so often that they just finally just said, we're going to just do this permanently.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so Mr. Mason then goes back to...
Mr. Mason was much attached to the principal, but was afraid such a fetter might be dangerous in time of war. He suggested the necessity of preventing the danger of perpetual revenue, which must of necessity subvert the liberty in any country. If it be objected to on the principle of Mr. Rutledge's motion that public credit may require perpetual provisions, that case might be accepted, it being declared that in other cases no taxes should be laid for longer term than blank years.
Mm-hmm.
He considered the caution observed in Great Britain on this point as the palladium of the public liberty.
Right. Okay. So, all right. And they keep going on with the debts and so forth. But for the most part, they bring up militia a little bit later on down the road here. And so we jump from 324 down to 327. So it's a few pages down. And Mr. Gary starts talking about standing armies.
Mr. Gary took notice that there was no check here against standing armies in time of peace. The existing Congress is so constructed that it cannot of itself maintain an army. This would not be the case under the new system. The people were jealous on this head, and great opposition to the plan would spring from such an omission. He suspected that preparations of force were now making against it. He seemed to allude to the activity of the governor of New York at this crisis in disciplining the militia of the state. He thought an army dangerous in time of peace and could never consent to a power to keep up an indefinite number. He proposed that there shall not be kept up in time of peace more than 1,000 troops. His idea was that the blank should be filled with 2,000 or 3,000. Instead of build to equip fleets, to provide and maintain a navy, agreed to...
Without any objection.
Oh, okay. Agreed to without any objection as a more convenient definition of the power. To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces added from the existing Articles of Confederation.
Okay. So now they're actually looking at the Articles of Confederation saying, okay, well, these things were granted, so we need to make sure we grant these things too. Okay, so Mr. Martin and Mr. Gary.
Now regularly moved, provided that in time of peace, the army shall not consist of more than 1,000 men.
Okay. Now, General Pinckney
asked whether no troops were ever to be raised until an attack should be made on us.
Right.
That's a good question. If there be no restriction, a few states may establish a military government. Mr. Williamson reminded him of Mr. Mason's motion for limiting their appropriation of revenue as the best guard in this case. Mr. Langdon saw no room for Mr. Gary's distrust of the representatives of the people.
Okay, so it's kind of interesting that Gary said, hey, can they now establish a military government? How would that be Republican?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Dayton, this is this nice exchange. And actually, some of the things that they've kind of brought up that maybe we want to kind of dive into here is that they started talking about, you know, do we wait to form the militia until we're attacked? Not having a standing army? And actually, when it comes down to a standing army, and this concept of a standing army was not a military force. What is the militia to do as the United States Army? What's their first role and responsibility? Go look it up during break, because we're going into break. Go look up Article 1, Section 8, and look for they shall have the power to call forth a militia. Look at what they're supposed to be able to do when calling forth a militia. And so as we dive into this, folks, you're going to be surprised that this standing army is not really a military force per se, but it is. And we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so when we look up in the Constitution, Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia. What is the first responsibility? To execute the laws of the Union. Mm-hmm. So a standing army, and you get, folks, you got to keep in mind that the king's army were the same people that went and fought a war, as well as drew their swords on the people to say, thou shalt do this, or we will force you into the prisons and kill you, or whatever brute force they want to use. This gets into more detail when we actually go through the ratification debates, but it's very clear that there was this huge concern over standing armies. And it had nothing to do with the ability to maintain war. It had everything to do with being able to enforce federal law. When we talk about checks and balances, if they have a professional law enforcement entity, let's say the FBI, let's say the IRS, let's say the BLM, let's say the Forest Service, or you know the Forest and Park Services, or let's say they have something like the Food and Drug Administration. It doesn't matter. If they can enforce laws, they have the justification of putting guns on their hips and whatever other arsenal that they want to carry in and act like thugs. The check and balance that they placed in this Constitution was that we, the people, had to enforce the laws that they created. In other words, we would be called up to go serve on a temporary basis, which meant that we would not be so quick to pull the trigger on our own family.
Right.
And that right there, because 9 times out of 10, when it came to enforcing the laws, they overkilled. I mean, when you look at what they went into West Pennsylvania over the Whiskey Rebellion, I mean, they took a very large, I'll just say, federalized army from 4 different states as they marched in there because they wanted to have overwhelming numbers so that when they came in, you know, everybody would just, oh, shoot, look at all these people. There's Washington. Let's not fire at that guy. So let's just keep going, though.
We have Mr. Dayton. I went up and then lost my spot.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Dayton, preparations for war are generally made in peace, and a standing force of some sort may, for aught we know, become unavoidable. He should object to no restrictions consistent with these ideas. The motion of Mr. Martin and Mr. Gary was disagreed.
Objection. Okay. In other words, they were disagreed. They were rejected, technically.
Okay. Mr. Mason moved as an additional power to make laws for the regulation and discipline of the militia of the several states, reserving to the states the appointment of the officers. He considered uniformity as a necessary in the regulation of the militia throughout the Union.
Okay.
Mr. Pinckney, General Pinckney, mentioned a case during the war in which a dissimilarity in the militia of different states had produced the most serious mischiefs. Uniformity was essential. The states would never keep up a proper discipline of their militia.
Okay, so which is one of the reasons why they included in the following subsection in Article 1, Section 8, that the federal government would be responsible for arming, equipping, and training. However, the training will be conducted by the states, not the federal government. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
Mr. Ellsworth was for going as far in submitting the militia to the general government as might be necessary, but thought the motion of Mr. Mason went too far. He moved that the militia should have the same arms and exercise and be under the rules established by the general government when in actual service of the United States, and when states neglect to provide regulations for the militia, it should be regulated and established by the legislature of the U.S. The whole authority over the militia ought by no means to be taken away from the states, whose consequence would pine away to nothing after such a sacrifice of power. Uh-huh. He thought the general authority could not sufficiently pervade the Union for such a purpose, nor could it accommodate itself to the local genius of the people. It must be vain to ask the states to give the militia out of their hands.
You see, they're coming to the brilliance of, you know, this wandering that they're doing. You know, that we need to do this, but we can't do that, and we need to do this. And so this whole point of we want to make sure that this is maintained in the hands of the people, not by mercenary forces of people by hire.
Right.
Right. Look at what we have today. We actually have professions that are nothing but law enforcement. I've been in this conversation lately regarding law enforcement, and every Christmas I bring out the fact that the only city that established a local law enforcement was New York City. You know what year that was?
Mm-mm.
Take a wild guess.
1913.
What was that? 1913?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, no, it was 1826. So how was law enforced prior to having the New York police force or the municipal police of New York City?
The militia.
Well, the sheriff.
Okay,
and the sheriff, as things started growing, the sheriff obviously, you know, because if it was a large county, and let's say in the area of New York, where, you know, New York City and these other large boroughs were, they were all within one county. Why? Because there was a lot of waterfront and there was a lot of, you know, opportunities of commerce and exchange and so forth. So they started creating these boroughs. I mean, when you talk about boroughs in New York, what's that? Brooklyn, right? That's a borough. Mm-hmm. And so as we see the county, the sheriff didn't actually have a bunch of deputies. He had posses. And if he needed to go into Brooklyn, into that borough, and he needed assistance, he would call for his posse, deputize them so that while they rode, they could get paid. Now, what do you do if you're a guy that just enjoys riding horses and shooting your gun? You would love to be paid to do that all the time.
Yeah.
And so there's people, believe it or not, there's people that wanted to do that. And so they were always available whenever they had the opportunity. Well, eventually they started creating a profession to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point is that we have to look at mercenary forces as antithetical to a free society. We actually have the responsibility of enforcing the laws ourselves and holding ourselves and everybody accountable to the law.
Yeah.
That makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. So why is it that we abandoned the militia at the county level? Because when we get into the ratification debates, this is where they're actually going to be expounding upon the militias will be apportioned based on the county population. And it will be, you know, appropriate to serve the people of that county. If they have circumstances that dictate that they need more, then they can go to the governor, and the governor will allocate resources from other counties. And if they don't have enough resources, because, boy, the people are pissed today, right? They're really mm-hmm. uprising now. And so then he would be able to go to the federal government and say, can you please send us assistance? Mm-hmm. You'll actually find that where? In the Constitution. Sure. So in the Constitution, there are these restrictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you go to Article 1, Section 10, this is kind of the last part of this. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty or tonnage, duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in peacetime, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded, or in such imminent danger as it will not admit of delay. So in other words, they were told that they couldn't just have a military force to just go do something, but in the necessity where they were in imminent danger, then they could actually immediately act. They didn't necessarily need Congress to give them a thumbs up. That makes sense, right?
Right, so unless actually invaded, so yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
So when we understand this ultimate check and balance that they started, these men didn't realize what they were doing, or I should say, they understood the dangers, they understood the pitfalls, those types of things, but I don't think they understood the real gravity and the genius of what they ended up creating. To where we, the people, were on the hook as members of the militia of enforcing the laws of the Union and basically suppressing insurrections and repelling invasion. So, okay, so let's go on from where you were.
Okay, so Mr. Sherman seconds the motion, and Mr. Dickinson, we are come now to the most important matter, that of the sword. His opinion was that the states never would nor ought to give up all authority over the militia. He proposed to restrain the general powers to 1/4 part at a time, which by rotation would discipline the whole militia.
Okay, that's brilliant. Okay, so that's brilliant, though, because they wanted to make sure that everybody was trained, even though they were only in, you know, in service for, like he said, by rotation, so they would be part-time. In other words, the entire state would be broken down into 4 parts. And so you wouldn't basically say, okay, this, you know, quadrant is 1 part, this quadrant. No, what you do is you would identify 1 out of 4 in, you know, so that you'd have 4 rotations in every town, every city, and so forth, so that you would have this equal rotation. Now, in these days, the militia was men. The militia is men and women today. Even though the state constitutions say, you know, men of this age will serve, who has the responsibility of establishing the standards and those types of regs? The federal government.
Yeah,
they're the ones that establish the standards. So they're the ones that say you will provide militia members, men and women, and they don't have an age limit. Actually, there is an age limit. I think it's 15 to 60-something, something like that, or 50-something. But anyway, the bottom line is the federal government has the responsibility. And so there's certain things that the state has to do. Why does the state have to do this? And why is it required of the state to have a militia?
Now or then?
Well, It's still today, still to this day.
It's in the Constitution.
It's in the Constitution because, bottom line, the existing system that they created today was only to deal with external threats.
Mm-hmm.
But the real reason of the militia was to deal with internal threats as much as external. When you look at repelling or suppressing an insurrection, that's clearly all internal.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have they used the militia to suppress insurrections or protests?
I don't know.
The first one was the Whiskey Rebellion. So the federal government didn't have to deploy many forces after that. But I'm here to tell you that they should actually have to federalize the militia and go into, and they should have done this when Trump, during his presidency, when they started actually doing the Black Lives Matter, you know, protests, all of the, it should have happened under Obama as well. But Obama was one that was, you know, very happy to shred the Constitution, to just let's light it up, let's burn it. So, okay, so anyway, let's keep going.
Okay, so Mr. Butler, where are we at? Mr. Butler urged the necessity of submitting the whole militia to the general authority, which had the care of the general defense. Mr. Mason has suggested the idea of a select militia. He was led to think that would be, in fact, as much as the general government could advantageously be charged with. He was afraid of creating insuperable objections to the plan. He withdrew his original motion and moved a power to make laws for regulating and disciplining the militia, not exceeding 1/10 part in any 1 year, and reserving the appointment of officers to the states.
Okay, so now they're looking at, you know, making containments on, you know, how much of the time, how much spending, and so forth. Okay. You know, you got to remember, if you notice, some of the names actually have ranks, like Colonel Mason, General Pinckney, and so forth. So many of these men, you know, actually spent time as officers in the militia or actually in the Revolutionary Army. General Pinckney.
General Pinckney renewed Mr. Mason's original motion for a part to be under the general and part under the state governments would be an incurable evil. He saw no room for such distrust of the general government.
Okay. So they were kind of supporting Colonel Mason. Anyway, okay, keep going.
Mr. Langdon seconds General Pinckney's renewal. He saw no more reason to be afraid of the general government than of the state governments. He was more apprehensive of the confusion of the different authorities on this subject than of either.
Okay. Now Mr. Madison pipes in.
Mr. Madison thought the regulation of the militia naturally appertaining to the authority charged with the public defense. It did not seem in its nature to be divisible between two distinct authorities. If the states would trust the general government with the power over the public treasure, they would, from the same consideration of necessity, grant it the direction of the public force. Those who had a full view of the public situation would, from a sense of the danger, guard against it. The states would not be separately impressed with the general situation, nor have the due confidence in the concurrent exertions of each other.
Okay, so obviously, if you're going to trust us to tax you, and we have to have coercive power to be able to do that, because we have learned that if we ask you for money, you won't just give it to us. But if you know that we can bring in men, some of the same men that live in your state, you know, into your offices and say, you will pay us. So it's interesting how, even though we look at the ratification debates as the real fight between the anti-federalists and the federalists over a Bill of Rights, what's interesting is we actually see that it was a lot more than just that, because there was a lot of talk regarding the militia. There was a lot of talk regarding the judiciary and so forth and so on. And so the fact is that as much talk as there was about the judiciary, and there was no mention of the forthcoming amendment that the 11th Amendment became, because every state, most every state, actually, at least those that vigorously debated the Constitution, because they weren't just going to rubber stamp it. They vigorously debated the federal jurisdiction in cases between the state and a citizen that was not a citizen of the state or a foreigner. And so they said, we don't like the fact that the federal government have jurisdiction on that. And so they basically, after out the gate, had ran into a couple of issues, and they said, you know what? We're done with this. We're going to get you, give us an amendment, or we'll do it ourselves. And that's what ended up happening. Congress gave them the 11th Amendment. Okay, so Mr. Ellsworth then.
Mr. Ellsworth considered the idea of a select militia as impracticable, and if it were not, it would be followed by a ruinous declension of the great body of the militia. The states will never submit to the same militia laws. 3 or 4 shillings as a penalty will enforce obedience better in New England than 40 lashes in some other places.
Okay.
Mr. Pinckney thought the power such and one as could not be abused, and that the states would see the necessity of surrendering it. He had, however, but a scanty faith in militia. There must be also a real military force. This alone can effectually answer the purpose. The United States had been making an experiment without it, and we see the consequence in their rapid approaches toward anarchy.
Okay, so what was the real military force that he talked about? In the Constitution, in its final form, what was, because you got to, let's look at it this way. He's basically saying that we actually have to have a true military force so that it can answer to the purpose. Where did they view the real threat to the United States to be?
Offshores.
That's right. Yeah. That's why you said the Navy. Mm-hmm. There you go. See? So as they were bringing up these points, because Pinckney, being an army man, wanted to see an army, a standing army. But the reality was that the army is only a threat to the people when you keep an army.
Right.
But when you keep a navy, it's actually not a threat to the people, and it is a better preservation of commerce for the nation, because its design is to protect that as well. Mr. Sherman then opined and said this. Go ahead.
Mr. Sherman took notice that the states might want their militia for defense against invasions and insurrections and for enforcing obedience to their laws. They will not give up this point. In giving up that of taxation, they retain a concurrent power of raising money for their own use.
Okay. Mr. Gary.
Mr. Gary thought this the last point remaining to be surrendered. If it be agreed to by the convention, the plan will have as black a mark as was set on Kane. He had no such confidence in the general government as some gentlemen professed, and believed it would be found that the states have not.
Okay, now back around to Colonel Mason.
Colonel Mason thought there was great weight in the remarks of Mr. Sherman, and moved an exception to his motion of such part of the militia as might be required by the states for their own use.
Okay, so in other words, when the militia wasn't in the service of the federal government, what were they to do? Well, technically, they were to augment the sheriff when necessary. And the question is, because the militia fell under whom in the state?
I don't know.
Well, so they fell under the legislature.
Oh, okay.
But they, when in operation, they were handed to the executive, the governor.
Okay.
Okay. So if it was at a state level, so the governor was kind of, he couldn't create the rules and regulations. That's what the legislature had to do.
Right.
So that's what Congress had to do. When they federalized the militia, the president then steps in and becomes the commander in chief. Because that's his responsibility. Once the militia has been called forth, he becomes the commander-in-chief and basically issues his orders as to what needs to be done. This is our mission, or what have you. Now, one of the things that I think is kind of interesting is that the president has a lot of latitude in those missions. I would think that Congress had probably learned a few lessons of allowing that, and I would have thought that they might have actually created an amendment that would, I would just say, contain the executive from being able to take liberties with the militia. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because when many times we see the executive utilize the militia in fashions and ways that they really don't have that authority.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Mr. Reed then finally pipes in.
Mr. Reed doubted the propriety of leaving the appointment of the militia officers in the states. In some states, they are elected by the legislatures, and others by the people themselves. He thought at least an appointment by the state executives ought to be insisted on. Yeah.
Okay. And then they go into this kind of this committee to the committee to vote on it. And so they basically vote, and it's only two states that vote no, which is Connecticut and New Jersey. So as they move forward and they go on and on and on, we are probably, you just need to move on to the militia again, August 21st. And we've got 1 minute left, so there's no, a little over a minute, so there's no point in jumping into this. But why did the militia, why did this military force, you know, instead of it actually just being basically, okay, you got this army, why was there such scrutiny in regards to the militia, its utilization? You know, where did they lay out the lanes? Who controlled what? Who did what? Why was this so important?
I mean, because they didn't want the powers to be overstepped.
Okay, so let me read the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Mm-hmm.
The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. In other words, the responsibility, let's change one word. It both starts with an R. The responsibility of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Right.
Now, when you look at it, they wanted to make sure it was a right, because if it's a right, it can't be taken. If it's a responsibility, but there's a big difference in the usage of that word. In other words, you have a right to bear arms, but actually, you also have a responsibility. I would have probably leaned on adding or including both. That the right and responsibility of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So with that, thank you so much for your help this week, and hopefully you're learning.
Yep.
And so we will forego the finale here, and actually not forego, we're not going to bypass it. So as we sign off today, I'm hoping that you're starting, this is where we first started actually getting into the militia was today. So hopefully we're starting to see these brilliance, or I should say the genius of the checks and balances of our Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.